Today is December 13th, 2014, and this is class on the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, we'll start with paying homage to the Buddha three times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato Sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Is anybody familiar with this book?
Yeah.
A lot of people. I was looking at this the other day, connection with the sutta we'll be studying today. I came across the interesting passage that I think attracted many of us in the early stages to Buddhism. Among the founders of religions, the Buddha, then in brackets, if we are permitted to call him the founder of a religion, in the popular sense of the term, was the only teacher who did not claim to be other than a human being, pure and simple. Other teachers were either God or his incarnations in different forms or inspired by him. The Buddha attributed all his realization, attainments, and achievements to human endeavor and human intelligence. He was so perfect in his humanness that he came to be regarded later almost as superhuman. Then there's another book. I don't know how many people know this book. This is by Piyadasi Thera. It's called The Buddha's Ancient Path. Sounds a little bit like an echo of Walpola Rahula's book. One of the noteworthy characteristics that distinguished the Buddha from all other religious teachers is that he was a human being with no connection whatsoever with a god or any other supernatural being. He was neither God nor an incarnation of God, nor any mythological figure. He was a man, but a superman, an extraordinary man. Okay, so this is a little bit of the background to the sutta we'll be taking today, which is called the Acharya Abhuta Sutta, the sutta on wonderful and marvelous qualities. So bear those passages in mind, and we'll see what we can make out, how we can understand the present sutta. Okay, so this sutta begins on page 979. This is sutta number 123, called Wonderful and Marvelous. Starting on page 179. Okay, when the sutta begins, a number of monks are sitting in the assembly hall after their arms round and meal, and they're having a discussion, and they're saying it's wonderful, it is marvelous, how mighty and powerful is the Tathagata, for he is able to know about the Buddhas of the past who attained final Nibbana, who have broken out from the tangle of proliferation, who have broken the cycle, ended the round, and overcome all suffering. He's able to know about those blessed ones, what their birth or social class was, what their names were, what their clans were, what their virtue was. Then the next is what their Dhamma was, which is interpreted to mean what their state of concentration was, what their wisdom was, what their attainments were, and what their liberation was like. And so, first thing, anything that strikes us, comparing this passage that starts here with what we read in these popular books on Buddhism from Walpola Rahula and Piyadasi Thera. Anything interesting stand out at once? So the Buddha Gautama or Shakyamuni, he's able to know all of these things about the Buddhas of the past, their names, their social class, their lifespans, their virtue, their sila, their samadhi, their wisdom, their liberation.
All the Buddhas were people.
Excuse me?
All of them were human beings.
All of them were human beings, yeah.
You asked what?
But anything that strikes out as being rather curious or interesting. Richard?
Well, these are not things that ordinary human beings know.
Yeah.
You have to have some means of knowledge
yeah.
that other people don't have.
Yeah.
So there's at least there's a kind of significant difference between the way of, of being that the Buddha has and the way that the rest of us have.
Yeah, that's one thing. There's something else that struck me as interesting in this passage. Okay, the Buddha is able to know about the Buddhas of all of these things, this information about the Buddhas of the past.
But he doesn't know what they were talking about. But, I mean, he asked, why did
That's an interesting point. I wasn't thinking about that. But the commentary has a way of getting around that.
He doesn't know about the Buddhas of the future? Or
no, I wasn't thinking of that. Okay, maybe I should say what I had in mind. The fact that there are multiple Buddhas, you know, if you hear the Buddha is a human being, one thinks he's quite a distinct and unique human being, but yet now it turns out that being a Buddha is a kind of repetitive archetype, something which is repeated over, again and again, over cosmic time. So that was the first thing that struck me. As to the problem Dina mentioned, how come the Buddha has to ask what the monks were talking about? What the commentary says, I think it's fairly believable about this, on this point, that the Buddha actually does know what they're talking about, but in order to open the conversation, he has to ask what they're talking about. Okay, so this conversation is going on amongst the monks. Okay, then the Venerable Ananda tells the monks that the Tathagatas are wonderful and have wonderful qualities. They are marvelous and have marvelous qualities. Okay, then what happens, and this is a kind of very typical scene that we come across in the suttas, the Buddha, while the monks are in the assembly hall having a conversation, the Buddha is alone in his cottage. Then at a certain time, he emerges from his meditation. He goes to the assembly hall, and then he asks the monks, what is the conversation that you are having that was interrupted when I arrived? Okay, so then the monks report to the Buddha what went on in his absence. Okay, then the Buddha turns to the Venerable Ananda and he says, that being so, Ananda, explain more fully the Tathagata's wonderful and marvelous qualities. Okay, now Ananda starts speaking and he says, I heard and learned this, Venerable Sir, this is, he uses the word Bhante, from the Blessed One's own lips, mindful and fully aware. The word translated fully aware here is sampajano, which I translate clear, with clear comprehension. So with mindfulness and clear comprehension, the Bodhisattva appeared, that is, was reborn into the Tusita heaven. Since mindful and clearly comprehending, the Bodhisattva appeared or was reborn in the Tusita heaven, this I remember as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Blessed One. Okay, so this passage is referring to the Buddha's last birth before he descended down to earth to take rebirth and become the Buddha. So it's said that in his last human existence, he was the prince by the name of Vaisantara, who practiced what would seem to be extraordinary acts of giving or self-sacrifice. In fact, some of his acts of self-sacrifice would strike us today as being a bit strange or incomprehensible. Like a cruel Brahmin came to him and asked him for his two children, I think it was a son and a daughter, so that he could have them to work as slaves. And Vaisantara was a prince, and yet he gave his two children to the cruel Brahmin in order that he could perfect the virtue of generosity. And so today, you know, where we have like laws about child labor and laws against slavery, and certainly, you know, the parent has a responsibility to look after the children and bring up the children in a healthy, nurturing, supportive environment, just to give them away to a cruel master who's going to abuse them and work them to the bone. Knowingly to do that would seem highly irresponsible. But the way it's depicted in the Buddhist text, that as a father he has so much attachment to the children, and so he wants to break the attachment, and so he gives his beloved children away. And eventually, I think he also gives his wife away. It turns out that the person who is the cruel Brahmin, you know, everything has a happy ending, is not really a cruel Brahmin, but it's Saka, the king of the gods in the Tavatingsa heavenly realm, who's appeared on the human level in order to test the bodhisattva's generosity by asking him to make these supreme acts of relinquishment. So eventually the children come back, the wife comes back, and everybody lives happily ever after.
That's pretty exactly parallel to the story of Abraham and Isaac.
Actually, there is a very close parallel there. For those who have not been brought up in a in a Jewish environment, Abraham has decided to devote himself to the God. This is the God Yahweh, who has sort of selected him from all of the people in his community as a special favorite. And then Yahweh, or God, wants to test the devotion, the dedication of Abraham. So he asks Abraham to make a sacrifice for him, and in fact to sacrifice his beloved son Isaac. And so Abraham, with great sorrow and reluctance and affliction, decides he has to fulfill the will of God, and so he brings Isaac to the place of sacrifice, and he lays him down on the sacrificial altar, and I think he has the knife or the sword up in the air, just about to kill him, when God tells him, "I was just testing you." That he wanted to what?
Salya Krishna did have two children. He wanted them to assist him in his old age.
Oh, I think the Jataka story makes it quite clear that he's going to exploit them and abuse them. Yeah. It's not like a kindly old gentleman who needs some... Okay, so anyway, after passing away from the human realm as king, as he becomes King Vaisantara, then the bodhisattva, through his practices as Vaisantara, he fulfills the paramitas, or the supreme virtues, and then he takes rebirth into the Tusita heaven, which in the Buddha's cosmology is 1, 2, 3, it's the fourth heaven in the sense sphere. So at the lowest level, there is the heaven of the four divine kings, then something called the Yama heaven, which is never really spoken about very much in the Buddhist text. Then there's Tavatingsa heaven, which is presided over by Saka, who is the sort of Buddhist metamorphosis of the Vedic deity Indra. And then above that is the Tusita heaven. And it's said that the Tusita heaven, that is supposed to be the abode of bodhisattvas before they pass away to take rebirth back into the human realm, where they'll achieve Buddhahood. And so in popular Buddhist belief, it's believed that now Maitreya or Maitreya is dwelling in the Tusita heaven, sort of accompanied by his retinue of deities, where he's teaching them the Dharma, and he is biding his time until the teaching of Gautama Buddha disappears from the earth, and then when conditions are ripe again, then Maitreya will pass away from the Tusita heaven and come into the human realm and achieve Buddhahood here as the Buddha Maitreya.
Is it a prerequisite that the Dhamma has to disappear before the Buddha can come?
Before another Buddha can come, yeah. Because otherwise there would be two Buddhas. Well, there won't be two Buddhas living at the same time, but there'll be one Buddha teaching while the teaching of another Buddha is in existence.
No, even after the Buddha passed away, and does the Dhamma itself have to disappear, or it has to?
Yeah, it has to, because the function of a Buddha is to rediscover the Dhamma at a period, during a period when it's not known in the world. Okay, so then, so Ananda says that this is a marvelous quality. I remember this as a wonderful and marvelous quality. Okay, now he comes to the next wonderful and marvelous quality. He says, mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva remained in the Tusita heaven. That is, through his duration in the Tusita heaven, he always maintained mindfulness and clear comprehension. And he did so in paragraph 5, where he remained in the Tusita heaven for the whole of his lifespan. In a way, this seems almost self-evident, but the point is that in the human realm and in the animal realm, the lifespan of beings varies a lot. So as human beings, you know, some human beings, almost as soon as they come out from the mother's womb, they die. So that being has a lifespan of maybe a day. Sometimes they live for 3 years, 5 years. Others might live healthy life for 20, 25 years, then they get sick and die. Others live to be 60, 70, 80, even, I think that there's a man alive today who's 120 years of age. But in the deva worlds, the lifespan is fixed for each deva world. And so there's a fixed lifespan in the Tusita heaven, and all of the deities who are reborn there live exactly for that full lifespan. Okay, now in paragraph 6, I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. Mindful and fully aware, the Bodhisattva passed away from the Tusita heaven and descended into his mother's womb. Okay, now remember, I hope I'm not being too ironic. The Buddha was the only teacher who did not claim to be other than a human being, pure and simple. Other teachers were either a god or his incarnation in different forms. But here is the Buddha's text saying that the Buddha had been a god who passed away from the deva world, passed away as a god, as in fact probably the chief god in the Tusita deva world, and comes into the human realm. And then what's noteworthy about this passage, unlike almost all other newly conceived infants, it says that mindful and clearly comprehending, he passed away from the deva, from the Tusita heaven, and entered his mother's womb. In other words, his mindfulness and his clear comprehension had been so fully developed that when he takes conception in the womb, he still has mindfulness and clear comprehension. I know that some contemporary physiologists or biologists say that at the moment of conception and in the early stages of embryonic development, you know, the brain, I mean, there isn't a brain. There's just, you know, a few cells which are dividing. And so there's not yet a base for any kind of higher mental functions. And yet the text here says that with mindfulness and clear comprehension, at the moment of conception, that the bodhisattva, at the moment of conception, has mindfulness and clear comprehension. So how to reconcile this with modern physiology? I don't know, I'm not a physiologist. Somebody here had the hand up.
Regarding the concept of God,
yeah.
Most readers are meaning to the talking to the creator.
I think it's better if you use that, because I can't.
They talk in terms of the creator God.
Yeah.
And Buddhism is not a creator God.
Yeah, that is true. It's not a creator God. Okay, so he, mindful and clearly comprehending, he descends into the mother's womb. Okay, then when the bodhisattva passed away and descended into his mother's womb, then a great immeasurable light appeared in the world, surpassing the splendor of the gods. Okay. When other human beings take rebirth, that doesn't occur. Okay, then when this measureless light appears in the world, then even in those what's called the abysmal world interspaces of vacancy, gloom, and utter darkness, where the moon and sun cannot make their light prevail, there too that great immeasurable light appeared. Okay, what is being referred to here? Now, according to the Buddha, early Buddha's cosmology, there are, in fact, it's interesting that the Buddha's cosmology speaks about world systems. It uses the expression in Pali, Chakravala. Which is rendered, usually rendered as chakka means a wheel. And so this is usually rendered as a world sphere. Or literally, it's like a wheel of worlds. And if you have seen photographs of galaxies, even the Milky Way galaxy and many other galaxies, they look very much like wheels. You know, they have arms that come around. Well, I'm not a good artist. You can go on Google Images and just put in galaxies. They look something like that. And each one of these lines is actually, this is just, you know, it's not really a continuous line, but it's actually made up of billions of stars, which are suns. Okay, so that there are many of these world spheres spread out in boundless space, and then in between a number of world spheres, there's areas, vast areas, which are supposed to be very, very dark because they're not occupied by the world sphere. And so it's said to be like a place where three wheels meet. If you can imagine three wheels sort of lined up, then there'll be space between them. And that is called these dark, abysmal, is the expression used here, interspaces. And it's said that these are occupied by beings. It's a sort of unfortunate realm of rebirth. maybe they're a kind of preta, and they think that they're living all alone there. So each one feels pretty much like isolated within his own little cell or solitary confinement. But when that splendor arrives there, then it says that the beings there perceive each other by that light, and they think, ah, so indeed there are other beings reborn here. And then the 10,000-fold world system shakes and quakes and trembles, and there too a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appears.
Just recently I read something about purgatory in Buddhism.
Yeah.
So are these interspaces purgatory?
Or what's called the hell realms? I think when they use the word purgatory, they're referring to what elsewhere we call hell. Of course, all the hells in Buddhism are, in a sense, purgatories. Of course, there's no everlasting hell, but one gets reborn in the hell realm, undergoes a certain amount of affliction, and then one passes out when one exhausts that karma and takes rebirth elsewhere. I think that they might be regarded as a kind of hell realm, but I'm not sure. I'd have to do some to look into that.
These wouldn't be considered black holes in what we view them, that void that he's talking about?
I don't think so. I think these are more like, in modern cosmology, the dark spaces between galaxies. Because the black hole is supposed to be formed when a star explodes, that it sort of expands outward, but then the gravitational force, it starts to contract, and then the gravitational force builds up so much power that it sucks in everything, including light itself. So even light can't escape from the black hole, and so it registers as a completely black area.
Because it sounds like when it says, where the sun and moon, mighty and powerful as they are, cannot make their light prevail.
Yeah, I mean, this is still using like an ancient Indian cosmology rather than a modern cosmology, because now we know that what's called the sun and moon is just the center of this one little solar system, and the moon is just a satellite that's turning around our planet Earth.
This translation sounds like something out of the 60s, flower power, the abysmal work.
Somebody, a student of astronomy here? If I say anything wrong about modern astronomy, then correct. Okay, let us just continue. Now, I thought it's interesting that the previous two suttas are on emptiness, sort of reaching continually, deeper states of meditative and philosophical abstraction until there's almost nothing left. And now we come to all of these wonderfuls and marvels. A little bit, this is like the theme in Chinese Buddhism, what they call profound emptiness and marvelous existence. Is that the expression used? What is it in Chinese? You don't know that expression? There's an expression, empty.
没有真空.
Right. Shouldn't it be the other way? 真空, 没有. It's the other way, is it? That's true emptiness, marvelous existence. So suttas 121, 122 seem to be dealing with true emptiness, and here we're dealing with miaoyo, marvelous existence. Okay, we continue. And notice here, this is also interesting in the sutta. And in fact, it suggests that the sutta is of later origin, and yet there's something that we come to at the very end which negates that thesis that it's of later origin. What makes me think it's of later origin is that the sutta is always being stated with Ananda speaking, saying, I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's own lips. And yet I don't, from many of these passages, I don't recall seeing them elsewhere in the Sutta Pitaka. And so, you know, if somebody wants to compose a sutta and insert it in, and he doesn't want to directly ascribe the words to the Buddha, so he can have Ananda saying, I heard this from the Buddha's own lips. And yet these ideas have become so integral to the Buddha's tradition that virtually all the schools of Buddhism have adopted them. And whenever one sees in temples, for example, in Sri Lanka, images of the different stages in the life of the Buddha, one will see these scenes illustrated. Like many of the temples will have the picture of the Buddha, well, as the Bodhisattva in the Tusita heaven, sort of sitting, they're all sitting on clouds with the blue sky in the background, and the Bodhisattva is like the head or at the center of the assembly, and all the other devas are sitting around the Bodhisattva with their hands in Anjali, like this. Then there'll be the picture of the Bodhisattva's, or the Buddha's mother, lying on her bed. And the birth, the conception scene is usually represented by a white elephant with six tusks coming down sort of in a cloud and hovering above the belly of the mother. And each of the other key events that's being described here will have its own picture to illustrate it. Okay, it continues, when the Bodhisattva had entered into his mother's womb, then four young deities came to guard him at the four quarters, that's the four main directions, so that no humans or non-humans or anyone at all could harm the Bodhisattva or his mother. So these four, according to the commentary, these four young deities are the four chief devas of the heaven of the four great kings. So the heaven of the four great kings is presided over by four deities. Each one is in charge of a particular one of the four directions, north, east, south, west. And each one is the chief of a particular class of beings. One of them is the chief of the Nagas, those are the dragon spirits. Another is the chief of the Yakshas, who are fierce demonic spirits. Another is the chief of the Gandharvas, who are depicted as celestial musicians. And the fourth is depicted as the chief of the Kumbandas, who are kind of gnome-like being that's supposed to be guardians of hidden treasures. Okay, then when the Bodhisattva has entered his mother's womb, then she becomes intrinsically or naturally virtuous in that she spontaneously observes the five precepts. She doesn't kill living beings, doesn't steal, doesn't commit sexual misconduct, doesn't utter any false speech, and doesn't use intoxicants. And then not only does she abstain from sexual misconduct, but according to the next paragraph, she doesn't have any sensual thought concerning men, and she becomes inaccessible to any man having a lustful mind. I guess the idea here is that once the bodhisattva is in her womb, then she doesn't have sexual relations, even with her husband, the king. But, according to the next paragraph, when the bodhisattva has descended into her womb, then she easily obtains the five objects of sensual pleasure and enjoys herself with them. That is, she doesn't indulge in sexual enjoyment, but she always has lovely sights to see, maybe gardens and flowers and palace, curtains of the palaces, fountains with nice colorful birds and other wild animals. And she gets to hear maybe lovely music from the court musicians and gets nice fragrances and perfumes and incense and delicious food and soft, delicate bed sheets and shawls and clothes. Then in paragraph 12, because she never gets sick when the bodhisattva is in her womb, and she always feels happy and joyful, but even more, she sees the bodhisattva inside her womb with all his limbs lacking no faculty. And this is just like seeing a man with good eyesight takes a gem in his hand and can look at it and distinguish the different features of that gem. And so she's able, I guess, through a kind of divine eye to see the bodhisattva in her womb as he's undergoing the different stages of embryonic development. Okay, then the next paragraph here seems a little bit out of place, almost as though it got wrongly positioned here, and it seems to belong properly sometime later in the sutta. Because so far we haven't come to the birth of the bodhisattva, and yet it says, 7 days after the birth of the bodhisattva, his mother died and was reborn in the Tusita heaven. And according to the commentary, the reason why the bodhisattva's mother passes away right after he's born is after the bodhisattva has sort of used her womb as the place of gestation. Her womb cannot be used again by anybody else. In other words, she can never give birth again to another child. And so it seems to be, maybe according to Buddhist tradition, a fixed law that whenever any Buddha is born, his mother will pass away within 7 days after his birth. And yet she's a woman of great merit. She, according to the tradition, she had made many, many past lives under another Buddha. She had made the vow to become the mother of a bodhisattva, or the mother of a Buddha. And so she would have had great merits, and then she passed away and she was reborn in the Tusita heaven. And then there is a fixed tradition within the Pali commentaries. I think it's preserved within all of the Buddhist traditions, all the early schools in one form or another, that after the Buddha achieved Buddhahood, in order to repay the kindness of his mother, he spent one rains retreat. That's the three-month period when it rains in northern India, usually from sometime in July to sometime in October. So he spent that period in the Tusita heaven, or actually, according to tradition, actually, he went to the Tavatimsa heaven for the sake of his mother, and his mother came to the Tavatimsa heaven, and deities came from all of the other heavenly realms and from many world systems in order to hear the Buddha teach. And according to the Theravada tradition, what did the Buddha teach when he was went to the heavenly realm to instruct his mother out of gratitude for her kindness? What did he teach?
Abhidhamma.
Right, the Abhidhamma. Because it's said that the Buddha has to teach the Abhidhamma in 3 months in one sitting. Everybody's sitting continuously for 3 months. And in the human realm, it can't be done. It takes much longer to explain the Abhidhamma, even though I'm almost doing it. 2 years ago, I did it in 3 days, covered two chapters. This past year, 5 days, covered four chapters. But to explain the whole Abhidhamma system with all its complexities and elaborations, it said we have to teach continuously for 3 months. Use the microphone.
Regarding the death of the mother, Buddha after, one week after Buddha, not that used to trouble me to some extent. Then I saw somewhere that actually the confinement, birth of Buddha, happened 10 months before she was destined to die. In other words, her karmic energy was exhausted. And it is only at that time. It's not that her birth, the birth of the Buddha killed the mother.
No, that's not said to be the case.
I used to feel, how can such a noble person be born and the mother dies?
No. It's said to be like a fixed principle that after a bodhisattva is born in his last existence, then the mother passes away. Okay, now we're on paragraph 14. It's said that other women give birth after carrying the child in the womb for 9 or 10 months, but the bodhisattva's mother gave birth to him after carrying him in her womb for exactly 10 months. I don't really know the reason for this. Maybe it takes somewhat longer time than for an ordinary person for a bodhisattva's body to fully develop. Okay, then continuing, it said that other women usually give birth seated or lying down, probably in most cases lying down. Not so the bodhisattva's mother. She gave birth to him standing up. And does anybody know where she gave birth to him? What is the name of the garden? Oh, you have to know that. Very famous. Still exists today. What? Say it? Right, Lumbini. It's now in over the border, the Indian border in Nepal. It's just the short way over the border. But in those days, it used to be a real pain in the neck to get a visa to cross the border. Maybe they've eased it up. And there's a pillar there, which was set up by the King Ashoka, the Indian King Ashoka, who was a devoted Buddhist, and he traveled to most of the sacred places of Buddhism, and he erected a pillar which still has engraved in stone, I guess in Brahmi letters, the inscription, "Here the sage Sakya, well, here Shakyamuni, the sage of the Sakyans, was born." And if you go to Lumbini, you could see that pillar.
Mate, being that she was reborn and to seek to heaven, does that mean she was a bodhisattva also, or?
No, you see, in the Tusita heaven is not occupied exclusively by bodhisattvas. But she would have been on her way to enlightenment in some
because
form.
Because it's a higher realm. I mean,
yeah, but I think the Tusita heaven is probably divided up into different areas. Maybe she was in the circle around Maitreya Bodhisattva? I don't know, actually. It would seem a little bit weird that if she gives birth to Gautama Buddha, that she would leave the human realm and then connect herself to Maitreya. Why choose somebody who's, you know, a few steps behind her own son? Somebody else was going to say something? Okay, let us continue then. Oh yeah, so she gives birth standing up in the Lumbini garden, and according to other texts, when she gives birth, how she could do it standing up, because it must be very stressful on the body of a woman, she holds on to the branch of a tree, and then the branch of the tree supports her, and then the infant comes out from her womb. Okay, then continuing, it said, when the bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, first devas received him, then the human beings. So I guess because when the bodhisattva comes out, he's so, you know, pure and radiant, and the deities are going to pay homage to him and reverence to him first. And so the deities receive him. And in this standard picture that one sees in Buddhist temples, the mother is holding on. This is Mahamaya. She is holding on to the branch of a tree. The infant has already come out, and the deities are holding him up.
Mate, it doesn't say anything about, was she like immaculate conception also?
There's nothing about an immaculate conception here.
Because it just says he comes down from that to seek to heaven into the womb.
Yeah, but it's never said that this is a case of immaculate conception. And, well, according, this isn't in the suttas, but I think this comes and maybe in the traditional stories, that she had never been able to conceive before, that, you know, so she wasn't a virgin. In fact, actually, the Immaculate Conception has a different meaning. It doesn't mean that Mary, the mother of Jesus, was a virgin, but what it means in Catholic theology is that all other human beings are supposed to have been reborn with original sin sort of imprinted on their souls. But Mary is the one human being who is born without that stamp of original sin in her soul. Because she is the one who's sort of predestined to give birth to Jesus.
But supposedly she also was impregnated by the Logos, the Word. I mean, it wasn't...
Yeah, this is actually... an interesting point in that this is the way it's come down in the Gospels, but you see, at the time the Gospels were composed, the Jewish sources, the Old Testament, had been studied and preserved, had been preserved and studied not in the Hebrew, the original Hebrew, but in the Greek translation of the Old Testament or the scriptures of Judaism. Now, in Hebrew and in the section of the Old Testament on the prophet Isaiah, it said the prophecy is that the Messiah or the Savior will come forth from a young girl. A young girl will give birth. A young woman will give birth. Now the word in Hebrew, which means young girl, when the Jewish scriptures were translated into Greek, the word that means young girl was translated by the word which means virgin. And so in the Greek translation of the prophet Isaiah, it said that the Savior will come forth from a virgin. And then one finds the statement of the virgin birth, if I remember, I'm not sure if it's in Matthew. It's not in Mark. I don't think it's in John.
No, it's not in John.
Oh, you
No, I'm familiar with it.
But it's in Luke, certainly in Luke. Richard, do you?
Well,
Matthew
is the one that I can't answer that, but I do know this.
Take the microphone.
The doctrine of the Virgin Birth and of the Immaculate Conception are doctrines.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Right. And the doctrines of the miracles and so on become more and more pronounced as you go, as the dating gets
yeah.
later. That
yeah.
the Gospels are written in sequence.
Yeah.
The later ones are the ones with the more miraculous conceptions. And I think
that I'm not so sure about, because this isn't a class in biblical the New Testament, but of the four Gospels, the one that's generally regarded as the oldest is Mark.
Yeah.
No. In the arrangement that comes in the New Testament, Matthew comes first because it seems to have been the most popular. But according to biblical scholars, Mark is regarded as the oldest.
Well,
yeah.
Yeah, the thing that I wanted to say is that I think the significant issue is that they're dealing with the same theological problem. That is, it's not that there are identical doctrines, it's that there are the same pressures on the formulation of theology after the fact. So that the doctrine of the Immaculate Conception is dealing with is the Christian way of coping with the same problem that's here, because they're saying then in paragraph 9, the Bodhisattva descended into his mother's womb, she became intrinsically virtuous, refraining from killing, etc. The reason for that in Christian theology is stated. That is that Mary had to be entirely pure and relieved of original sin because Jesus as a good son was required to obey every one of her commands, and she was in charge of him. And so none of her commands could command him to do something imperfect. So she had to be perfect. That's the problem. That's the way that the theology develops to solve that problem in both cases. It's a logical implication that is hammering on the heads of the theologists, and so they have to deal with it somehow. And that's also one of the things that indicates that this is a later text, because it's finding a way to cope with that problem, which presumably had been the subject of a lot of questions from monks and probably also people outside. Well, how could an imperfect mother, have a perfect son?
That I never heard before. I don't want to.
That's the Catholic doctrine. That's obviously the same issue.
The Immaculate Conception is the Catholic doctrine, but is it part of Catholic doctrine that the reason for the Immaculate Conception is because she has to be a perfect mother in order to give perfect...
That's what I've been told by ministers and priests,
Okay. I don't know Catholic doctrine, so I...
Well, there's a...
I have enough dealing with Buddhist doctrine.
Right! There's a related question. What puzzles me is what is the relationship between a Buddha being a Bodhisattva being born into the reincarnation of which will become a Buddha, and a non-returner being born into the incarnation of which you'll be an Arahant?
Okay, the Bodhisattva, to become a Buddha, has to be born into the human world, and he has to be born of a mother, through a regular human birth.
Yeah.
Whereas a human being becomes an anagami, so they're not going to come back into the human world. They're going to have to be reborn usually into the form realm, particularly into this, the heavens, which are called the pure abodes. And when they're born in the pure abodes, then they are of what's called spontaneous birth, that is not born of parents, but you pass away from the human realm and then just spontaneously re-arise in...
I'm talking about the birth of someone who's being born to be a non-returner.
Oh, to become a non-returner.
Right, yeah. I want to know, what's the difference of that? Because that birth would seem to have the same requirements that here are being attributed to the birth of a bodhisattva is about to become a Buddha. But what is the difference between an arahant and a tathagata, right?
Yeah. Anyway, let's get on to maybe we could save this for the discussion period. Because I want to continue on to the track of... The one thing that struck me during the discussion, I'm not sure whether, even though the Buddhist tradition doesn't depict Mahamaya as having been a virgin at the time that she conceived Siddhartha, the future Buddha. But I don't know that it depicts the conception as taking place as a result of sexual intercourse. It seems from the way it's depicted, it's just as if when the time is ripe, the bodhisattva passes away and then just takes conception in the mother's womb. But it could be that, because conception doesn't take place immediately after sexual relations, but the egg is fertilized and then there is some time before it becomes viable. So it might be that the bodhisattva descends and enters the mother's womb only when the egg becomes viable. Somebody can correct me if my physiology is incorrect. But let us continue so that we can finish the sutta. Because we're coming to the really interesting passage. Okay, the gods receive him. When the bodhisattva comes forth from the mother's womb, He did not touch the earth, not immediately, but the four young gods received him. Presumably those are the chief deities of the heaven of the four great kings. And then they set him before his mother, saying, "Rejoice, O queen, a son of great power has been born to you." Okay, then when he comes out from the mother's womb, he's unsullied by any of the fluids of the body, the yuma's blood or any kind of impurity. He comes out clean and unsullied. Maybe here you could see the Indian and specifically Buddhist idea that the body is inherently impure, and so we don't want to have, even though the bodhisattva has to be reborn from the mother's womb, but we don't want him to be sullied or the body to be covered by any of the bodily fluids. Now, in some of the later Buddhist traditions, like this would be the tradition of centered around the figure Padmasambhava, who is the man who brought Buddhism from India, at least one of the chief figures who brought Buddhism from India to Tibet. His very name, Padmasambhava, means born of a lotus, lotus born. So the conception, or the concept here, the idea is that, you know, he is so holy that he can't be reborn even from the mother's womb, but he just appears spontaneously. There's supposed to be a lake someplace up in Odhyana, which is in the north, far in the northwest. Now I think it's in Pakistan, that region. And a lotus appears there, and then at a certain point the lotus opens up, and lo and behold, there's a little child sitting there, cross-legged in the meditation posture, and that becomes, grows up to become Padmasambhava. Okay, then when he's comes out from the mother's womb, then two jets of water appear from the sky, one cool and one warm, for bathing the bodhisattva and his mother. Okay, next, this is where we come to the really wonderful and marvelous quality. Okay, Ananda says, "I heard and learned this from the Blessed One's lips. As soon as the bodhisattva was born, he stood firmly with his feet on the ground. Then he took seven steps facing north, and with a white parasol held over him," there would be a deity here holding the white parasol, "he surveyed the four quarters, the four directions, and then he utters this," it's called the words of the leader of the herd. The leader of the herd is the chief bull in the herd. So this is like a powerful proclamation. So he says, "I am the highest in the world. I am the best in the world. I am the foremost in the world. This is my last birth. Now for me there is no renewal of existence." So we see pictures of this quite common in the Buddhist temples. And even here on the Buddha's birthday, we have the image is depicted in the fountain. Each fountain has a little Buddha image with the Buddha looks like a baby wrapped in a baby's, what do you call it? Swaddling cloth. But still with features that are recognizable as those of a Buddha, and one hand is pointing up, the other hand is pointing down. Because I think the way the text comes down in the Chinese tradition is in the heavens above and in the earth below, I alone am the exalted one or the foremost one. And to us, you know, maybe it sounds somewhat boastful to be saying, I am the foremost in the world, I am the best in the world. But I think we could see that this is like the Buddha, the way the Buddhist tradition conceives the Buddha. And so they would be ascribing these words to him. Or maybe the Buddha himself can utter them because from his perspective, it's an objective truth. It's not, the proclamation is not made out of pride, conceit, or arrogance. Okay, then the commentary gives a sort of symbolic explanation to the different features of the scene. We could look at the note here. That's 1165. I'm not sure that the commentary doesn't take this scene to be literal, but it also sees symbolic meanings in each aspect. So it said, this is on page 1337, that when he stands with his feet firmly on the ground, this is a foretoken of his attaining the four bases of spiritual power. This is because the word feet in Pali is pada, and the term for the bases of spiritual power is iddhipada, which is literally the feet of psychic power. Okay, when he's facing the north, now the word for north in Pali is uttara, which means, another meaning of uttara is superior, because the north is upwards. So uttara can be either north or superior. So the symbolic significance of this is that he has gone above and beyond the multitude of ordinary people. Okay, when he takes seven steps, that represents his taking, his acquiring the seven factors of enlightenment. The white parasol, and white is sort of the color of purity, signifies his acquiring the parasol of liberation. Then surveying the four quarters, four directions, you're looking everywhere. So that is supposed to signify his acquiring what's called the unobstructed knowledge of omniscience. And then when he utters that proclamation, that is a foretoken of his setting in motion the wheel of Dharma after he achieves enlightenment. And then when he says, this is my last birth, that is a foretoken of his passing away into final nirvana. Okay, then we come to the last of the marvelous qualities mentioned by Ananda, that when the Bodhisattva came forth from his mother's womb, again a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendor of the gods appeared in the world. And again the beings in the dark abysmal spaces between the galaxies are able to see each other and to recognize other beings are here, and again the world system shakes, quakes, and trembles. Okay, so when we look at all of this, all of these wonderful and marvelous qualities, this is where I say it, there's a certain problem with the sutta. All of this seems to be like so, you know, if we ended there, we could say, okay, this must be a later text. It sort of represents the Buddhist community can't accept the fact that the Buddha was a human being. How does Walpola Rahula put it? A human being pure and simple? Yes. He did not claim to be other than a human being pure and simple. So we can't accept that. We have to have him with full consciousness, first living his past life in a deva world, passing away from the deva world with a great flood of light appearing at the time, with all sorts of marvels accompanying the period of his mother's pregnancy, deities accept receiving him when he comes out from the womb, taking seven steps and making a proclamation, and great light suffusing the whole universe. So it seems like you could say, okay, the early Buddhist monks got carried away with the fervor of their emotional devotion and had to sort of embellish the birth of somebody who was a human being, pure and simple. And so one would be tempted to say, you know, this is all a later development, which could easily have been just slipped into the Majjhima Nikaya. But then we come to this paragraph here, number 22, which seems to be like the Buddha almost issuing a rejoinder, a response to this fervent devotion, which is sort of focused upon miraculous and wondrous events. So the Buddha says, "That being so, Ananda, remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata. That is, for the Tathagata, feelings are known as they arise, as they remain present, as they pass away. Perceptions are known as they arise, as they remain present, as they pass away. And thoughts are known as they arise, as they are present, as they pass away." And then to put extra emphasis on this, the Buddha repeats it, repeats his instruction to Ananda, and he says, "Remember this too as a wonderful and marvelous quality of the Tathagata." And then Ananda repeats it. And so it seems here that the Buddha is almost sort of sweeping away all of these miraculous, or at least diminishing the importance of all of these wonderful and miraculous events surrounding his conception and birth, and saying that the true marvel, wonder and marvel is that, you know, through developing my mind, I'm able to be aware of feelings, perceptions and thoughts as they arise, as they are present, and as they pass away. And this is not said to be a special, unique quality only of the Buddha, but it's also said to be a quality of somebody who is in training, of the monks in training. For example, let's say Sutta 41, Anguttara Nikaya, Book of the Fours, I think it's Sutta number 41. Or it could be 51, 41 or 51. It's on four kinds of concentration. And one of those four kinds of concentration is called the concentration that leads to mindfulness and clear comprehension. And it's explained that a monk is aware of feelings, perceptions, thoughts as they arise, as they remain present, as they pass away. And then I believe there's also a passage in the Samyutta Nikaya, it might be in chapter 36, where the Buddha is telling monks who are sick that they should be mindful and clearly comprehending. Then he raises the question, what is mindfulness? And he explains it by way of the standard formula for the four foundations of mindfulness. Then he says, what is sampajanya, clear comprehension? Or how does a monk have clear comprehension? He is fully aware of feelings, perceptions, thoughts as they arise, as they remain present, as they pass away. Okay, and that takes us to the end of the sutta. If anybody has a quick question or comment, we could take it now. Otherwise, we could come back for the discussion at 12:30. What, it's funny?
No. He likes acquiring my stuff.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the Buddha concludes with the general characteristics of impermanence, but not of suffering and non-suffering. Just an observation.
Well, I think the point here is not to bring in the three characteristics, but just to show that he's aware of these three aspects of experience in each of their stages. Oh, yes, please. There's another microphone here.
Just a quick comment. I was reading, there's a phrase in I Ching, it's also a very ancient Chinese.
Yeah.
So I mentioned about for a human to be formed. For a human to be formed, there has to be yin yang ji qi. So the original says, gu ren chi sheng ye, yi he yin yang ji qi, gu fu mu ji jing, liang jing xiang bo, xing sheng nai cheng. And there's more. So I think my understanding is that there has to be those two elements.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that has some reference to how Buddha or Jesus were born.
The two elements would be the male and the female?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You know, I should say, I mean, again, coming back to the Bible, the idea of the virgin birth of Jesus, again, it comes through this translation of the Hebrew word meaning young woman into Greek as virgin, and then it gets inserted into certain of the Gospels in order to connect the birth of Jesus with the prophecy of the prophet Isaiah. But as far as Mary being a virgin, I'm afraid that there are some passages in the Gospels which speak about the brother of James, the brother of Jesus. So Mary had other children after Jesus. Yeah, I mean, it's a fact. Okay, so let us end now with the sharing of the merits. Then we can come back, we'll say 12:30, for some discussion. And then next week, the class next week, even though I didn't put it on the original list, but I think it would be interesting to look at sutta number 124, which focuses upon a monk, one of the disciples of the Buddha. His name is Bakula. And if you want to know who Bakula is, when you're going up, you know what is called the Bodhi path? That is the path going up to the big hall, the main hall. There are stone images of 18 arahants along the way. If you're facing the big hall going up, then on the left you'll see one statue of a monk with a little beard, and next to him is an animal that looks something like a leopard. Fierce-looking animal, like a leopard. So that is Bakula. Okay, so let us end with the sharing of the merits. So we share the merits with the devas, including those in the Tusita Deva world, the nagas or dragon spirits, the bhutas or the fair spirits, and with all beings. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodiva chirang rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodiva chirang rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahitika punyanta nganumoditva chirang rakantu mangparam. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe satanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagupadaya avichihetato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukkha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin.